This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jackie Shelton Green was recently named Poet Laureate for the state of North Carolina. She is only one of three women ever to hold the appointment and the first African American. She is also a mother, a Southerner, and a teacher. And she brings all of these voices and more to her work as a poet and an instructor of documentary poetry at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. Jackie Shelton Green has won many honors for her work, in addition to being named Poet Laureate. So you might be surprised to learn that she didn't set out to be a writer. She wanted to be an oceanographer. Let's find out what happened. Welcome, Jackie Shelton Green. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's always wonderful to be with you.
It's a pleasure. Take us to that moment now when you learned that you were named Poet Laureate.
The governor called me on my birthday, Juneteenth, June 19, and my telephone rang, and I did not recognize this North Carolina number. I thought it was a telemarketer, but I answered it. And he said, "I'm Roy Cooper calling for Jackie Shelton Green." My response was, "Roy Cooper as in my governor of North Carolina?" And he said, "Yes, your governor." And I said, "How may I help you?" Roy Cooper said, "I am pleased to call you to inform you that I have appointed you as the next Poet Laureate of North Carolina." And it was quite an emotional hysterical moment for me.
Yeah, especially when you're wondering, who is this guy really?
Exactly. You know? I wasn't sure it wasn't a joke.
It could have been Eric Hodge calling a trip to Italy for all you knew. But this is all the more exciting in some ways because here you are, Poet Laureate of North Carolina, but you didn't really expect or want to be early on as you were imagining careers for yourself. Imagine yourself a writer.
Exactly. I've always been a writer since a child. It's true that in my early years growing up, I really wanted to be an oceanographer. But my father reminded me that I had never seen the ocean, never been to the ocean, that I did not know where the ocean lived, and I should probably rethink this. So it was actually my grandmother's stories and her continually telling me, you must tell the stories, the importance of what it means to tell, to keep legacy of story. And that's my journey. That's my journey to writing. And on this journey, I never, ever had the insight or the mindset of one day I will be the Poet Laureate of North Carolina. My mindset was always, I want to write good work. I want to perfect my craft. I want my poems to be functional, to really matter, and to be a model for other people to write and to tell their stories.
What does that mean, to be functional?
I believe that art should be functional. I like the functionality, the everydayness, the ordinariness of art. So when I'm writing poems, I'm sometimes asking myself, what is the function of this piece? Will it serve as a container for grief? Is it a container for joy? Is it a container for sorrow? Is it a container for confusion? But what is its purpose? And that purpose goes beyond me. It has to go out into the world and be functional for someone else.
How far along would you be in the process before you ask that question?
Well, that differs because sometimes the poem tells me what its reason for being born is. I don't always know. I feel like sometimes I'm just a vessel. You know, I show up inside of the poem. The pen guides me. And I allow it to take me where it needs to go. But sometimes that's very soon. Sometimes it is intentional. I joined a group that was writing poetry of lamentation a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I was on the show. We talked about this, the Resisting Arrest anthology about police brutality. So I knew that poem was a container for that sorrow, for that regret, for the anger, for the violence, and hopefully for the reconciliation of that.
You talked about the importance of your grandmother in steering you and guiding you to become a writer, even though you weren't intending to do it maybe early on. And she told you a story about her grandmother that's very important. Tell us that story.
Well, my grandmother's, it's a very long story, but my grandmother's grandmother was the property of the white plantation owner who owned her, who was also her father. My grandmother's grandmother was secretly taught to read and write by her white siblings. And when that was discovered, she was severely beaten and was denied entry into the big house ever again. But she was also sold. Years later, my grandmother's grandmother's mother was able to buy her back. And I have a nail that fell from the buck wagon of the other plantation owner who'd purchased her, who was taking her away. My grandmother's grandmother's mother picked up that nail, and that nail has been passed down.
She followed the wagon.
She ran behind the wagon, screaming. Yeah. So my grandmother's lesson to me in all of this is that someone who looked just like you almost lost their life just because they knew how to read and write. So literacy, reading and writing, has always mattered significantly in my family. So this was the charge.
And obviously this artifact has been passed down from generations. So in that moment,
yes,
is that a lot of pressure in a way? I mean,
it is, because the responsibility of keeping what we keep keeps us. The responsibility of keeping that nail. And what does it mean to keep? What does it mean to keep the story? What does it mean to build the containers to preserve the story, to pass the story on?
I wonder if you can read a poem, because you talked about certainly the importance of your grandmother, and you wrote a poem called Praise Song that I think illustrates some of this and certainly your respect for her.
Praise Song. You, woman tree, woman one, swaying to unheard of winds, uninvented airstreams. You, woman sky, with palms broad enough to hold Egypt, who taught me to walk slow and deliberate, like I had somewhere to go, who taught me stories that needed telling, to love men and women who need it, who taught me to fetch life out of the depths of rivers, taught me the words that the tree branches sang to wake the sun and bring morning home, who taught me to love loving with my eyes wide open, who taught me to dance and smile in rhythm, to clap with an open heart.
Poet laureate Jackie Shelton Green, her poem Praise Song, dedicated to her grandmother. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh is hosting a tribute to Jackie on Sunday, August 26th at 2 o'clock, and she joins us live in the studio now. We've got that information, of course, at her website, stateofthings.org. Talk about the love of clapping with one heart, accepting and loving. It's interesting, because if you tell the story about a young girl beaten and sold because she learned to read, you might not think that when that story is handed down, the words love and acceptance are the message that are transmitted, but that's what came through.
Yes, because inside of the legacy of slavery and its atrocity, we forget to talk about the legacy of survival, the legacy of continuance, the legacy of those seeds that continue to ripen. And I am that ripened seed. And her story is on my tongue. It has to be there. And I have to become her sometimes. I have to think about what that legacy, the journey of her story is. And often I'm thinking about, what is the anatomy of the voice? What is the anatomy of the voice by which I tell her story? You know, if you think about that anatomy being the anatomy of a slave girl, then I am very much writing through the DNA of that, if that makes sense.
Well, tell me more about that, because again, we're talking about these two beautiful, this confluence of the abstract, the use of words in a creative way, and then a nail, a rusty nail, you know, and sort of the concrete. And you talked about the usefulness of poetry, the anatomy of a voice, and it has a tangible biological certainly idea attached to it. But then there's something else when you get into the spirit of someone long since gone.
Right, because you think about the fabric, the texture of not just the nail, but who held that nail and where the nail was. The nail was inside of the side of a buck wagon. How many other people has that wagon transported? How many other mothers have run behind buck wagons looking for children, searching for children? So memory is a container that I use to dig deep in. Memory I like to think that we're all human museums. Mm-hmm. So that nail, that story, like many stories, are inside of that human museum.
There's concrete imagery there that you can then latch onto and bring us to kind of deeper depths. Meanwhile, your grandmother was just mostly trying to keep you from fidgeting in church when she put the first notebook in your hand, I understand. Is that true?
This is true. So as a child, and I still am fidgety in church whenever I'm there. Yes, my grandmother always had little tiny notebooks for me and pencils, and I would write my stories in church. And then I would graduate to write on hymnals and Bibles. And then I became an adolescent, and I had my own little diaries to take to church and really would capture the essence of story on Sunday mornings, the story inside of hymnals, the story inside of prayer, the story inside of people's faces. The way the women wore their hats, the way people showed up on Sunday looking very different from a Wednesday as working people.
Jackie Sheldon Green is my guest, the new poet laureate of the state of North Carolina, also an instructor of documentary poetry at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. We're sure to talk more about that. Growing up, your early childhood, that was in rural Orange County, right?
That's true. I grew up in Eflin.
Eflin, North Carolina. I love seeing the sign on 40 because I always think of Elfland.
That's right.
Everybody does that. But you also, you went to school, you went to boarding school in Pennsylvania. Tell us about that now.
Yes, I attended the George School, which is a Quaker boarding school in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which was a big departure from Eflin, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. It also was the landscape that really shaped and texturized my early writing and offered me the permissions to dig deep, to write, to understand the power of writing and just the vastness of writing, which I did not have the language for yet as a child in Orange County, if that makes sense.
What happened? What did happen? How did that?
This was the 60s. This was the late 60s, early 70s. So there was Cambodia. There was the Vietnamese War. There was the Civil Rights Movement. And as a young Southern rural African-American daughter of the other Confederacy of the South, I was claiming my, you know, my identity. I shouldn't say claiming because I wasn't really claiming yet. I was searching. I was searching and turning over rocks and, you know, I had this vast amount of stories of family lore, but then there were the new stories that were happening around me. And doing unto others as they would have, as you would have them do unto you was not working for me as a Black child in the South. I felt like I was doing all the right things and turning the other cheek. And it was a very turbulent time. So I was fortunate to have a full scholarship to attend the George School and to meet young people from all over the world and to interact with scholars and, you know, an open mindset that allowed me to have freedom as a young person to struggle with identity and to write.
Had you by then decided to be a writer, or was that, did that idea come to you at school?
Frank, I never decided to be a writer. That was evolution. I hadn't decided what I wanted to be. I'd first thought about being a lawyer because I saw the need for justice. Even at that age, I was a social justice activist. I was running all over New York and Philadelphia in my teens, attending anti-war protests. And in the South, I was fighting against desegregation and racism. But yes, more of who I was becoming was happening at the George School during my adolescence, with young people who also were artists and dancers and writers exploring. So I think that did put a stamp in my consciousness that this was a journey I could...
A journey that you could sustain as a working poet. You took on jobs and worked in areas that, as a paralegal, and in areas, I think, related to social justice and social improvement. Talk about those jobs.
Yes, I've always been in service-oriented jobs. When I moved back to North Carolina from Connecticut, I worked for the Department of Agriculture, and I worked with low-wealth families to teach them nutrition. So I visited families and homes and taught nutrition, which to me is activism.
Right.
And then I moved on to, I've done a lot of marketing and retail. And then I landed in legal services, which was a joy to, I started out in legal services as a community economic development specialist working with low-wealth communities. I taught nonprofit governance and worked with nonprofits that were building daycares and alternative schools and senior citizens, senior sites. And
were you writing the whole time?
Oh, I've never not been writing, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And people have always wondered, well, how could you have this cross-section of jobs and still be creative? Because all the work that I've ever done actually fed the work.
Yeah.
So the character sometimes showed up sitting across from me at a food stamp hearing.
Well, it's a weird when people ask that kind of a question. I mean, it does strike me that there are sometimes some fairly rigid ideas about what creativity is. Like you go to the creativity is figuring out how to get time to write a poem when you're busy.
Right.
Another creative act.
That's right.
Way,
and
so.
I think our culture really pushes us to be about productivity. It's always producing. And we don't always think about the quality of that production. Also, creativity has become like everything else. It has a brand. It's very branded. And I think when I was very young, I really was in awe of my friends who had the wealth to be able to go away to the beach and write all summer or go to their cabin in the mountains. And I did not have that financial accessibility. So the liminal spaces, the in-between spaces, were the places where I create. And I remind people now that we create our wealth of spaces, our sacred spaces, where the muse is always welcome. And sometimes it's not at the beach. Sometimes it's at the kitchen sink. And we remember that we're even scribing when we're peeling potatoes.
And you talked about it being a brand. And earlier you said that you'd spend some time in marketing and retail. You were in a retail establishment, namely a furniture store, when you met the man who would become your husband. Great story. Tell us
this
that one.
This is true. Abdul Latif and I have been married. We'll be 20 years next year. And I did meet him in a furniture store. I was looking for a fainting couch or chaise lounge. And he will tell the story that I found him, but I didn't get the chaise lounge. and he discovered my poetry. He went to the bookstore that afternoon. And he read the last poem, one of the last poems in the book, and decided he wanted to know me.
What was that poem?
The poem is called I Cry. The poem is written for my father. My father died April 4th on the same death date as Martin Luther King Jr. So there's a reference to my father and Martin. So the Martin in this poem is reference to Martin Luther King. And my daughter, Imani, who died 9 years ago, was also born on April 4th. So these three April 4s and these three people are monumental in the telling of the story.
Will you read I Cry for us?
I Cry. It is my father's ashes glistening on barren branches. The clouds were blood-stained in the shadow of ritual called crossing. To name is to replace. To praise is to erase. To dance is to fall. Bloodstains on red skin need not be removed from the lips of children unnamed or from the red crosses in skies untouched. To touch is to smear. Martin's voice was a piano key this morning, out of tune, sharp. It is my father's ashes glistening on barren branches, blood falling on earth, fertilizing the good earth. Dance, Martin. Claim your own cloud.
Jackie Shelton Green, North Carolina's poet laureate. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh is doing a tribute to Jackie on Sunday, August 26th at 2:00. That reading is called I Cry, about her father. When your husband, who is not yet your husband, cited that poem to you, what was your reaction to that?
One, I thought it was very interesting that that same day he went out pursuing my work. But two, that the poem really resonated with him. At the time, his father was still alive. Mm-hmm. But he said that the poem carried the character of the relationship that I had with my father. Mm-hmm. And that was what resonated with him. And that I could capture that, that I could write about the connectedness of Martin Luther King and my father in one solid voice. I think beyond that, his own poetry, which my husband does not talk about, does not share, I think it was a tie to himself, to his own creativity.
When you talk about Martin's voice is a piano key this morning, a voice was a piano key, the music, the number of images in that poem begin to swirl, and it comes together in a remarkable way. You've got ashes, there's blood, and then there's music. Do these ideas come to you in sequence, or do they come to you in a kind of a blur? Because when it comes out as a poem, the imagery is breathtaking, and you can't define it, which to me is the ultimate poem. It has an impact that I could never define, and that happened in this poem.
Well, again, Frank, I think that when we can lean into the source of the poem, the anatomy of that voice, I think it's easier for me to tap into those images. So when I'm tapped into the spirit of the poem, when I'm tapped into the emotional landscape of the poem, and not all of my poems have an emotional landscape, some are very abstract. But this poem, I wanted this poem to be abstract, but I wanted this poem to also, that the line structure would carry, that this was my father I'm talking about. That I'm talking about two men, the loss of two men, and the fact that MLK's death was like a sharp piano key out of tune. You know, we'd all been singing the song of Martin. Mm-hmm. And Martin's song was what was carrying us in the 70s. And then it was a screech. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to connect those. Right. So I'm always looking for the images that connect right. to the visual.
You also talked about your daughter and having lost her. This was, as you can imagine, very difficult for you. Talk about Imani, how important she was, and what was happening with you at this time.
Wow. So in 2008, late summer, August, Imani was diagnosed with a very aggressive malignant cancer that UNC, Yale Medical Center, and John Hopkins could not identify. It was very aggressive. She did chemo and radiation through December of 2008. In surgery, we were told that her cancer was gone, that they'd gotten it all in the surgery, and that she would be fine, and that all the doctors would be there to dance on her wedding. That was in March of 2009, and Imani died 2 months later on June 5th, 2009, 2 weeks before her wedding. So this was, of course, an event in the family that held us hostage emotionally, and just, we were pretty stricken. And I did not write. I could not write. I so wanted to write about Imani, but it was not time, and the words were not there. And I needed to be on that landscape. I needed to be in that boat out in the middle of the ocean. I could see all my family and friends on shore, you know, waving. But I knew I had to be out there by myself for a while, knowing that I was not going to perish, knowing that I was not going to drown, even though when the boat was in rocky water, and when it was time, I came back to shore.
So that didn't, I wondered about that. I wondered if that terrified you in some ways, that this is your gift, to be able to put into words the ineffable. And now here you are, wordless.
Yes, it is a wordless moment, and I think that we have to give permission to the silence. We have to give permission to sitting in that wilderness. We have to give permission to everything that we think is crazy, that, and I don't want to use the word crazy, it's confused. Everything inside of our mouth feels like glass. That just surrendering. And that surrender also is the wave that brought me back.
Is that anything that you have attempted to or would attempt to describe, that kind of silence, a silence that is not simply the absence of words, but the ultimate silence?
It's a roar.
Yeah.
You know, it's a roar. It's a silence, but it's a roaring silence. And it's one that just, I feel, this is the one time in my life I felt totally powerless. The one time Mama couldn't fix it.
Did you also then became seriously ill yourself, and it wasn't clear what was happening to you, right?
This is very true. So in 2011, 2 years after Imani's death, I was stricken with Lyme disease that was undiagnosed for an entire year. So it had pretty much done substantial damage. I was in intensive care. I was in a wheelchair for a few years. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. I could not process information. And it was the blessing of meeting a holistic doctor who delivered me back to health.
Well, because you were getting a lot of false, no diagnoses erroneous diagnoses.
Yes. Well, Duke was obsessed with cancer because Imani had just died from cancer. Mm. So I was having one biopsy after the other, just tremendous, too many biopsies. And when they did not find cancer, they released me and told my husband, and they were very sorry. They could not find what was wrong with me. However, I was indeed deathly ill and perhaps maybe had 3 months to live. So that was in October of 2011. We were introduced to a holistic doctor in Chapel Hill in 2012, February, and she diagnosed me with Lyme disease. Hmm.
What happened after that? Were you beyond treatment, or obviously you're better now?
Well, she treated me holistically, and of course, I'm here. No. I can talk, I can walk. But one of the side effects is my hands are crippled, because people also do not realize that Lyme disease triggers autoimmune diseases, and rheumatoid arthritis was that disease for me, that autoimmune disease. So my hands are damaged.
Meanwhile, in the depths of all of this, you think this is the ultimate test for your marriage. Your husband doesn't see it that way at all. Tell us how that went.
So it was a frightening time, and I felt very, very strongly that I did not want him to be burdened with taking care of an invalid wife for the rest of his life. This is not what he signed up for, and I wanted him to go away. I wanted a divorce immediately, and his response was, if you don't die, I will kill you. And his response was also, this is the thin of the thick and thin in our marriage vows, and I'm right where I'm supposed to be. And he is an amazing partner, an amazing soulmate, and I hate that word, but he is a soulmate. He is a tremendous human being. Mm-hmm. And has, you know, actually provided me the space, helping me to facilitate the spaces and the time to have this luxury, to be inside of my writing. I don't drive anymore, and I'm relying on him to get me every place I need to go. And that's a huge sacrifice.
What does he look at your poetry? Is he your first or anywhere in the line editor?
Oh, he's my first reader. Yeah. And he's my first listener. Any new poem that I write has to go through him. And when I say go through him, he listens. He's an amazing editor. He's an amazing proofreader. And he will also tell me, stop eating up your auras, or you don't read that line so fast, or you need to enunciate this word better. So, yes, it's a blessing to have a partner who is excited about my artistry.
It's a good thing you needed that chaise lounge.
And I still don't have it.
You still don't have it. came out better in the long run. Talking to newly appointed poet laureate of North Carolina, Jackie Shelton Green, also an instructor of documentary poetry at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. We talked about your commitment to social service. Some of that you've done as a day job. Other times you have acted as a poet. You've been in prisons and talked with people there about voice. This is an important thing. Gets back to the theme that we talked about very early on, this business of being a voice and opening your voice. What kind of work do you do in prisons?
So for many years, I have worked in a North Carolina prison system, both men's and women's. I had the opportunity in the late 80s to do a residency at Women's Prison in Raleigh, and was working with women on death row, actually. And for 1 year, I showed up every Monday evening, and the assignment to the women, well, the subject matter for the women for that entire year, we could only write about hands. And I was thinking strongly about their stories of why they were on death row. And all of those stories always go back to their hands, the power of their hands, the power they did not know their hands possessed. And we did a lot of visualizations where I'd ask them to close their eyes and allow their hands to remember the last time they brushed their daughter's hair. And the story would be, my daughter's now 15. I've not seen her since she was 3, but I remember her hair inside of my hands. Or allow your hands to remember the last time you held your mother's hands or your grandmother's hands. And the story would be, my mother died 10 years ago, and I didn't get to see her. I hadn't seen her in 5 years before she died. But I know her hands are like stains inside of my hands. So those were the stories and the poetry. Because I also believe that all of our poems are located, lodged inside of our stories. And that our writing instruments become the shovel, the tool for the excavation of those poems. So that was a very rich experience for me, and because I am a teaching poet, and I always learn what I teach. I also wrote poems that year myself. And of course, they always come back to my grandmother's hands. But that was the impetus behind this body of work that came out of working with women on death row.
Would you read that poem, the one that you wrote?
I know the grandmother one had hands. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always in bowls, folding, pinching, rolling the dough, making the bread. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always underwater, sifting rice, bluing clothes, starching lives. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always in the earth, planting seeds, removing weeds, growing knives, burying sons. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always under the cloth, pushing it along, helping it birth into skirt, dress, curtains to lock out night. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always inside the hair, parting, plaiting, twisting it into rainbows. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always inside the pockets, holding the knots, counting the twisted veins, holding on to herself, lest her hands disappear into sky. I know the grandmother one had hands, but they were always inside the clouds, poking holes for the rain to fall.
I know the grandmother one had hands. That is a poem written and just read by Jackie Shelton Green, who is our poet laureate here in the state of North Carolina. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh is hosting a tribute to Jackie on Sunday, August 26th at 2 o'clock. We have information on our website, stateofthings.org. That poem, obviously very warm and rich in its certainly recall of your grandmother, and then the power of those hands and the creativity of those hands. I'm thinking back, though, to what you said about those women on death row who had been in prison probably for years. Those memories, when the last time they held their daughter's hair in their hands, what kind of impact does this have on them to have to really articulate so exquisitely this last moment?
That takes us back to that notion when I talked about we're all human museums, and what rooms do they need to go into? Where were they storing these memories? What rooms were locked for them? How did their poetry unlock those doors? And for me, I wanted them to think about self-forgiveness. I wanted them to think about asking their hands for forgiveness, asking themselves for forgiveness for whatever had landed them in prison in the first place. Because I think when we think about healing, we think about recovery, even we think about where they go next, there has to be a permission. And for many of them, it was very, very powerful because, again, what we keep keeps us. So to go back and to hold these hands, we did a lot of holding of each other's hands. We did a lot of making language with our hands, with each other, without language. And how do you convert that, channel that, interpret that into language on the page? So this was very different, challenging for some people who did not like to be touched, did not like to touch other people, or were afraid of their hands.
And maybe not ready to, and I think this is what you were getting at, to forgive themselves. Did you see that happening? Was it?
It was happening, but for one thing, it was the first time, other than perhaps ministry, clergy coming in, it was the first time that someone really talked about what does the process of forgiving look like when we're in charge of it and we can manage it on our own terms. So to be inside of our poetry and to look at what they'd written, which startled some of them, but it was very freeing and liberating to be able to laugh and celebrate that memory, even if that memory was a painful memory. Because some women were numb. They were numb. They'd forgotten how to feel. They'd forgotten what their daughter's hair felt like because that backward journey was just too painful. But, you know, our years working with them in residency, I think that we all arrived at that same place, that it was meaningful and instructive and, again, functional.
Well, what effect did it have on you? I mean, apart from when you wrote your poem, I don't mean reading theirs.
I am always honored and blessed and humbled to be in the presence of other people's work. There's a sacredness there to bear witness to someone's story, to bear witness to actually watching someone unravel into their story. Someone just coming apart in a good way to be able to tell that story or to share that story. So I've always stood for the possibility of how poetry heals. Poetry offers us deep emotional resiliency. Poetry offers us a bridge where we can stand on with others and not other each other, but to find our commonalities and to bridge us. And in the moment of being an instructor for the women on death row, I was right there with them. And our stories were inexchangeable.
Did it unravel you? Did you find yourself coming unraveled?
I found myself coming unraveled in the sense that I did not know when these women would leave the earth. That was unraveling. I actually had a fabulous opportunity of actually being at a conference at Duke where I was presenting. And there was a woman who took my workshop. And at the end, she walked up to me, very beautiful, very well-coiffed, well-dressed, elegant woman. And she said, "You don't remember me." And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't." She said, "I was on death row when you came and did the residency with us." And she said, "I was acquitted." She'd killed her husband. And we stood there and she talked about how she still does that exercise, that thinking about the power of her hands is very instructional, directive for how she shows up in her world. The power of our hands, the deeds we do.
The power of our hands, the tangibility, the palpability of our of our hands, then the power of those words, the concepts, power of poetry in our story, which points to the power of silence. And I've been thinking about this lately just because of the number of ways non-disclosure agreements have been in the news, and it occurs to me that non-disclosure agreements are things constructed by people in power to keep those who with a, in a subordinate role from using their voice. And it's structurally, but look who writes the non-disclosure agreement. It's a corporation or a president, somebody in power who then, and often in the when they're in the news, we're talking about women who are asked not to speak, not to tell their story.
And I think this is why art is so vital and art is so powerful in our culture right now. I think we run out of ways to fight. I think sometimes we are just, we're too tired. It's exhausting right now being other in this society. But it is art where many of us, music, dance, paintings, all of the art forms, we find ourselves over and over again not being silenced. The power of utterance and showing up in that. And I think this is why it's so important. And it's also what I tell my Duke students every semester. Be ye very careful about the lenses we make up about other people, that we know no information about. Someone walks in a room and our biases immediately tell us who those people are based on absolutely nothing but what's rattling in our heads. So I think that the same thing happens at the larger, the corporate level, at the administrative level of this country, is the power to other people. But I think the arts has a way of flipping that. And we have a way of turning that back against that corporate entity that says you will be quiet. And we walk over that. And we walk over that not violently, but art is violent. Art can be very destructive and intentionally destructive, as it should be, in the name of transformation and change and peace and trying to build a better community of humanity. And that's what the arts function for me, and I think for many other writers that I engage with.
And you're teaching this in the context of not so much the arts, I mean, but documentary production, right?
Yes, we're using primary and secondary sources fused with poetics to look at Hurricane Katrina, to look at what happened in Charlottesville last year, to look at a statue being toppled, to look at any number of things, sexism in America. My immigrant students are amazing in talking about different cultural practices from a documentary standpoint, that's just mind-boggling. So,
what do you mean? Yes. Give me an example of that.
One of my Asian students last year was telling me about this whole, I guess, tradition of unless you're married by a certain age, you're just like toast, and how it's so prevalent in her culture. And she did the research, she did the statistics, the percentages, but then wrote these powerful poems about the women in her family who have rebuked that and stand on their own ground as powerful women with voices and who are educated. But still, that greater society, just like we were talking about, this American greater society says something else.
So the first thing to do is recognize those social structures, constrictions, ways in which we are muted, and then find perhaps examples to the contrary, places where people are speaking out. Are you, let me just put it bluntly, are you optimistic? I mean, who's winning in this contest when you talked about the power, the violence of art to transform? Is it working?
I think you have to think about the lens that you're looking through to define what's working and what's not working. I guess I look for win-win solutions. I know that we're deeply embedded in a scary landscape. And I think that what I have to do, and it's what I tell people, my friends who are frustrated, my young, very young friends who are sad, is we have to keep building community where we are. We have to keep scratching in our own little backyards. If it's one person, one poem at a time, if it's me suddenly being able to talk to my neighbor two doors away, and this is I'm just talking, my neighbor 2 days away is not racist, but right. I'm just throwing that out there as a generality.
Yeah.
That if for the first time in 4 years since my racist neighbor moved in two doors away, that we actually had a conversation. That's a win for me. That we actually broke bread together is a win for me. That in my past, I've sat down with people who were Klansmen, and talked about what that looks like, what that means. The conversation, the power of dialogue. Now, am I seeking Klansmen out right now? No. I think that we have to know who our tribe is. We have to strengthen that tribe through compassion. And I think we have to be very, very, very careful again about the lens that we're building, you know, to define winning and losing, because we both know the power of media and the power of branding in terms of politics in our country.
Jackie Shelton Green, the newly appointed North Carolina Poet Laureate and instructor of documentary poetry at Duke University Center for Documentary Studies. Thank you so much, Jackie. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh going to host a tribute to Jackie on Sunday, August 26th, 2 o'clock. The event is listed at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.